This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Spy and the Traitor, the greatest espionage story of the Cold War, by Ben McIntyre. Read for you by John Lee. He had two lives, one open, seen and known by all who cared to know, and the other running its course in secret. Anton Chekhov, The Lady with the Dog. Introduction. May 18, 1985. For the KGB's counterintelligence section, Directorate K, this was a routine bugging job. It took less than a minute to spring the locks on the front door of the flat on the 8th floor of 103 Leninsky Prospect, a Moscow tower block occupied by KGB officers and their families, while two men in gloves and overalls set about methodically searching the apartment. Two technicians wired the place, swiftly and invisibly, implanting eavesdropping devices behind the wallpaper and baseboards, inserting a live microphone into the telephone mouthpiece, and video cameras in the light fixtures in the sitting room, bedroom, and kitchen. By the time they had finished, an hour later, there was barely a corner in the flat where the KGB did not have eyes and ears. Finally, they put on face masks and sprinkled radioactive dust on the clothes and shoes in the closet, sufficiently low in concentration to avoid poisoning, but enough to enable the KGB's Geiger counters to track the wearer's movements. Then they left, and carefully locked the front door behind them. A few hours later, a senior Russian intelligence officer landed at Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport on the Aeroflot flight from London. Colonel Oleg Antonievich Gordievsky of the KGB was at the pinnacle of his career. A prodigy of the Soviet intelligence service, he had diligently risen through the ranks, serving in Scandinavia, Moscow, and Britain with hardly a blemish on his record. And now, at the age of 46, he had been promoted to chief of the KGB station in London, a plum posting, and invited to return to Moscow to be formally anointed by the head of the KGB. A career spy, Gordievsky was tipped to ascend to the uppermost ranks of that vast and ruthless security and intelligence network that controlled the Soviet Union. A stocky, athletic figure, Gordievsky strode confidently through the airport crowds. Inside him, though, a low terror bubbled. For Oleg Gordievsky, KGB veteran, faithful secret servant of the Soviet Union, was a British spy. Recruited a dozen years earlier by MI6, Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, the agent codenamed Nocton had proven to be one of the most valuable spies in history. The immense amount of information he fed back to his British handlers had changed the course of the Cold War, cracking open Soviet spy networks, helping to avert nuclear war, and furnishing the West with a unique insight into the Kremlin's thinking during a critically dangerous period in world affairs. Both Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher had been briefed on the extraordinary trove of secrets provided by the Russian spy, though neither the American president nor the British prime minister knew his real identity. Even Gordievsky's young wife was entirely unaware of his double life. Gordievsky's appointment as KGB resident, the Russian term for a KGB head of station, known as a residentura, had prompted rejoicing among the tiny circle of MI6 officers privy to the case. As the most senior Soviet intelligence operative in Britain, Gordievsky would henceforth have access to the innermost secrets of Russian espionage. He would be able to inform the West about what the KGB was planning to do before it did it. The KGB in Britain would be neutered. And yet the abrupt summons back to Moscow had unsettled the Nocton team. Some sensed a trap. At a hastily convened meeting in a London safe house with his MI6 handlers, Gordievsky had been offered the option to defect and remain in Britain with his family. Everyone at the meeting understood the stakes. If he returned as official KGB resident, then MI6, the CIA, and their Western allies would hit the intelligence jackpot. But if Gordievsky was walking into a trap, he would lose everything, including his life. He had thought long and hard before making up his mind. I will go back. Once again, the MI6 officers went over Gordievsky's emergency escape plan, codenamed Pimlico, that had been drawn up 7 years earlier in the hope that it would never have to be activated. MI6 had never exfiltrated anyone from the USSR before, let alone a KGB officer. Elaborate and hazardous, the escape plan could be triggered only as a last resort. Gordievsky had been trained to spot danger. As he walked through the airport, his nerves ragged with internal stress, he saw signs of peril everywhere. The passport officer seemed to study his papers for an inordinate length of time before waving him through. Where was the official who was supposed to be meeting him? A minimal courtesy for a KGB colonel arriving back from overseas. The airport was always stiff with surveillance, but today the nondescript men and women standing around, apparently idly, seemed even more numerous than normal. Gordievsky climbed into a taxi, telling himself that if the KGB knew the truth, he would have been arrested the moment he set foot on Russian soil and already on his way to the KGB cells to face interrogation and torture, followed by execution. As far as he could tell, no one followed him as he entered the familiar apartment block on Leninsky Prospect and took the elevator to the 8th floor. He had not been inside the family flat since January. The first lock on the front door opened easily, and then the second. But the door would not budge. The third lock on the door, an old-fashioned deadbolt dating back to the construction of the apartment block, had been locked. But Gordievsky never used the third lock. Indeed, he had never had the key. That must mean that someone with a skeleton key had been inside, and on leaving had mistakenly triple-locked the door. That someone must have been the KGB. The fears of the previous week crystallized in a freezing rush, with the chilling, paralyzing recognition that his apartment had been entered, searched, and probably bugged. He was under suspicion. Someone had betrayed him. The KGB was watching him. The spy was being spied upon by his fellow spies. Part 1. Chapter 1. The KGB. Oleg Gordievsky was born into the KGB, shaped by it, loved by it, twisted, damaged, and very nearly destroyed by it. The Soviet spy service was in his heart and in his blood. His father worked for the intelligence service all his life, and wore his KGB uniform every day, including weekends. The Gordievskys lived amid the spy fraternity in a designated apartment block, ate special food reserved for officers, and spent their free time socializing with other spy families. Gordievsky was a child of the KGB. The KGB, the Komitet Gosudarstvennoy Bezopaznosti, or Committee for State Security, was the most complex and far-reaching intelligence agency ever created. The direct successor of Stalin's spy network, it combined the roles of foreign and domestic intelligence gathering, internal security enforcement, and state police. Oppressive, mysterious, and ubiquitous, the KGB penetrated and controlled every aspect of Soviet life. It rooted out internal dissent, guarded the communist leadership, mounted espionage and counterintelligence operations against enemy powers, and cowed the peoples of the USSR into abject obedience. It recruited agents and planted spies worldwide, gathering, buying, and stealing military, political, and scientific secrets from anywhere and everywhere. At the height of its power, with more than 1 million officers, agents, and informants, the KGB shaped Soviet society more profoundly than any other institution. To the West, the initials were a byword for internal terror and external aggression and subversion, shorthand for all the cruelty of a totalitarian regime run by a faceless official mafia. But the KGB was not regarded that way by those who lived under its stern rule. Certainly, it inspired fear and obedience. But the KGB was also admired as a Praetorian Guard, a bulwark against Western imperialist and capitalist aggression, and the guardian of communism. Membership in this elite and privileged force was a source of admiration and pride. Those who joined the service did so for life. There is no such thing as a former KGB man, the former KGB officer Vladimir Putin once said. This was an exclusive club to join, and an impossible one to leave. Entering the ranks of the KGB was an honor and a duty to those with sufficient talent and ambition to do so. Oleg Gordievsky never seriously contemplated doing anything else. His father, Anton Lavrentyevich Gordievsky, the son of a railway worker, had been a teacher before the revolution of 1917 transformed him into a dedicated, unquestioning communist, a rigid enforcer of ideological orthodoxy. The party was God, his son later wrote, and the older Gordievsky never wavered in his devotion, even when his faith demanded that he take part in unspeakable crimes. In 1932, he helped enforce the Sovietization of Kazakhstan, organizing the expropriation of food from peasants to feed the Soviet armies and cities. Around 1.5 million people perished in the resulting famine. Anton saw state-induced starvation at close quarters. That year, he joined the Office of State Security, and then the NKVD, the People's Commissariat for Internal Affairs, Stalin's secret police, and the precursor of the KGB. An officer in the political directorate, he was responsible for political discipline and indoctrination. Anton married Olga Nikolaevna Gornova, a 24-year-old statistician, and the couple moved into a Moscow apartment block reserved for the intelligence elite. A first child, Vasily, was born in 1932. The Gordievskys thrived under Stalin. When Comrade Stalin announced that the revolution was facing a lethal threat from within, Anton Gordievsky stood ready to help remove the traitors. The Great Purge of 1936 to 1938 saw the wholesale liquidation of enemies of the state, suspected fifth columnists and hidden Trotskyists, terrorists and saboteurs, counter-revolutionary spies, party and government officials, peasants, Jews, teachers, generals, members of the intelligentsia, Poles, Red Army soldiers, and many more. Most were entirely innocent. In Stalin's paranoid police state, the safest way to ensure survival was to denounce someone else. "Better that 10 innocent people should suffer than one spy get away," said Nikolai Yezhov, chief of the NKVD. "When you chop wood, chips fly." The informers whispered, the torturers and executioners set to work, and the Siberian gulags swelled to bursting. But as in every revolution, the enforcers themselves inevitably became suspect. The NKVD began to investigate and purge itself. At the height of the bloodletting, the Gordievsky's apartment block was raided more than a dozen times in a six-month period. The arrests came at night. The man of the family was led away first, and then the rest. It seems probable that some of these enemies of the state were identified by Anton Gordievsky. "The NKVD is always right," he said, a conclusion both wholly sensible and entirely wrong. A second son, Oleg Antonievich Gordievsky, was born on October 10, 1938, just as the Great Terror was winding down and war was looming. To friends and neighbors, the Gordievskys appeared to be ideal Soviet citizens, ideologically pure, loyal to party and state, and now the parents to two strapping boys. A daughter, Marina, was born 7 years after Oleg. The Gordievskys were well-fed, privileged, and secure. But on closer examination, there were fissures in the family facade, and layers of deception beneath the surface. Anton Gordievsky never spoke about what he had done during the famines, the purges, and the terror. The elder Gordievsky was a prime example of the species Homo Sovieticus, an obedient state servant forged by communist repression. But underneath he was fearful, horrified, and perhaps gnawed by guilt. Oleg later came to see his father as a frightened man. Olga Gordievsky, Oleg's mother, was made of less tractable material. She never joined the party, and she did not believe that the NKVD was infallible. Her father had been dispossessed of his watermill by the communists, her brother sent to the Eastern Siberian Gulag for criticizing collective agriculture. She had seen many friends dragged from their homes and marched away in the night. With a peasant's ingrained common sense, she understood the caprice and vindictiveness of state terror, but kept her mouth shut. Oleg and Vasily, separated in age by 6 years, grew up in wartime. One of Gordievsky's earliest memories was of watching lines of bedraggled German prisoners being paraded through the streets of Moscow, trapped, guarded, and led like animals. Anton was frequently absent for long periods, lecturing the troops on party ideology. Oleg Gordievsky dutifully learned the tenets of communist orthodoxy. He attended school 130, where he showed an early aptitude for history and languages. He learned about the heroes of communism at home and abroad. Despite the thick veil of disinformation surrounding the West, foreign countries fascinated him. At the age of 6, he began reading British Ally, a propaganda sheet put out in Russian by the British Embassy to encourage Anglo-Russian understanding. He studied German. As expected of all teenagers, he joined the Komsomol, the Communist Youth League. His father brought home 3 official newspapers and spouted the communist propaganda they contained. The NKVD morphed into the KGB, and Anton Gordievsky obediently followed. Oleg's mother exuded a quiet resistance that only occasionally revealed itself in waspish, half-whispered asides. Religious worship was illegal under communism, and the boys were raised as atheists. But their maternal grandmother had Vasily secretly baptized into the Russian Orthodox Church, and would have christened Oleg too, had their horrified father not found out and intervened. Oleg Gordievsky grew up in a tight-knit, loving family suffused with duplicity. Anton Gordievsky venerated the party and proclaimed himself a fearless upholder of communism, but inside was a small and terrified man who had witnessed terrible events. Olga Gordievsky, the ideal KGB wife, nursed a secret disdain for the system. Oleg's grandmother secretly worshipped an illegal outlawed god. None of the adults in the family revealed what they really felt, to one another or anyone else. Amid the stifling conformity of Stalin's Russia, it was possible to believe differently in secret, but far too dangerous for honesty, even with members of your own family. From boyhood, Oleg saw that it was possible to live a double life, to love those around you while concealing your true inner self, to appear to be one person to the external world, and quite another inside. Oleg Gordievsky emerged from school with a silver medal, head of the local Komsomol, a competent, intelligent, athletic, unquestioning, and unremarkable product of the Soviet system. But he had also learned to compartmentalize. In different ways, his father, mother, and grandmother were all people in disguise. The young Gordievsky grew up around secrets. Stalin died in 1953. 3 years later, he was denounced at the 20th Party Congress by his successor, Nikita Khrushchev. Anton Gordievsky was staggered. The official condemnation of Stalin, his son believed, went a long way towards destroying the ideological and philosophical foundations of his life. He did not like the way Russia was changing, but his son did. The Khrushchev thaw was brief and restricted, but it was a period of genuine liberalization that saw the relaxation of censorship and the release of thousands of political prisoners. These were heady times to be young, Russian, and hopeful. At the age of 17, Oleg enrolled at the prestigious Moscow State Institute of International Relations. There, exhilarated by the new atmosphere, he engaged in earnest discussions with his peers about how to bring about socialism with a human face. He went too far. Some of his mother's nonconformity had seeped into him. One day, he wrote a speech, naive in its defense of freedom and democracy, concepts he barely understood. He recorded it in the language laboratory and played it to some fellow students. They were appalled. "You must destroy this at once, Oleg, and never mention these things again." Suddenly fearful, he wondered if one of his classmates had informed the authorities of his radical opinions. The KGB had spies inside the institute. The limits of Khrushchev's reformism were brutally demonstrated in 1956, when the Soviet tanks rolled into Hungary to put down a nationwide uprising against Soviet rule. Despite the all-embracing Soviet censorship and propaganda, news of the crushed rebellion filtered back to Russia. All warmth disappeared. Oleg recalled of the ensuing clampdown, An icy wind set in. The Institute of International Relations was the Soviet Union's most elite university, described by Henry Kissinger as the Russian Harvard. Run by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, it was the premier training ground for diplomats, scientists, economists, politicians, and spies. Gordievsky studied history, geography, economics, and international relations, all through the warping prism of communist ideology. The institute provided instruction in 56 languages, more than any other university in the world. Language skills offered one clear pathway into the KGB and the foreign travel that he craved. Already fluent in German, he applied to study English, but the courses were over-enrolled. "Learn Swedish," suggested his older brother, who had already joined the KGB. "It is the doorway to the rest of Scandinavia." Gordievsky took his advice. The institute library stocked some foreign newspapers and periodicals that, though heavily redacted, offered a glimpse of the wider world. These he began to read, discreetly, for showing overt interest in the West was itself grounds for suspicion. Sometimes at night he would secretly listen to the BBC World Service or The Voice of America, despite the radio jamming system imposed by Soviet censors, and picked up the first faint scent of truth. Like all human beings, in later life Gordievsky tended to see his past through the lens of experience, to imagine that he had always secretly harbored the seeds of insubordination, to believe his fate was somehow hardwired into his character. It was not. As a student, he was a keen communist, eager to serve the Soviet state in the KGB, like his father and brother. The Hungarian uprising had caught his youthful imagination, but he was no revolutionary. "I was still within the system, but my feelings of disillusionment were growing." In this he was no different from many of his student contemporaries. At the age of 19, Gordievsky took up cross-country running. Something about the solitary nature of the sport appealed to him. The rhythm of intense exertion over a long period, in private competition with himself, testing his own limits. Oleg could be gregarious, attractive to women, and flirtatious. His looks were bluntly handsome, with hair swept back from his forehead and open, rather soft features. In repose, his expression seemed stern, but when his eyes flashed with dark humor, his face lit up. In company, he was often convivial and comradely, but there was something hard and hidden inside. He was not lonely or a loner, but he was comfortable in his own company. He seldom revealed his feelings. Typically hungry for self-improvement, Oleg believed that cross-country running was character-building. For hours, he would run through Moscow's streets and parks, alone with his thoughts. One of the few students he grew close to was Stanislav Kaplan, a fellow runner on the university track team. Standard Kaplan was Czechoslovakian and had already obtained a degree from Charles University in Prague by the time he arrived at the institute as one of several hundred gifted students from the Soviet bloc. Like others from countries only recently subjugated to communism, Kaplan's individuality had not been stifled, Gordievsky wrote years later. A year older, he was studying to be a military translator. The two young men found they shared compatible ambitions and similar ideas. "He was liberal-minded and held strongly skeptical views about communism," wrote Gordievsky, who found Kaplan's forthright opinions exciting and slightly alarming. With his dark good looks, Stander was a magnet to women. The two students became firm friends, running together, chasing girls, and eating in a Czech restaurant off Gorky Park. An equally important influence was his idolized older brother, Vasily, who was now training to become an illegal, one of the Soviet Union's vast global army of deep undercover agents. The KGB ran two distinct species of spy in foreign countries. The first worked under formal cover, as a member of the Soviet diplomatic or consular staff, a cultural or military attaché, accredited journalist or trade representative. Diplomatic protection meant that these legal spies could not be prosecuted for espionage if their activities were uncovered, but only declared persona non grata and expelled from the country. By contrast, an illegal spy, nelegal in Russian, had no official status, usually traveled under a false name with fake papers, and simply blended invisibly into whatever country he or she was posted to. In the West, such spies are known as NOCs, standing for non-official cover. The KGB planted illegals all over the world, who posed as ordinary citizens, submerged and subversive. Like legal spies, they gathered information, recruited agents, and conducted various forms of espionage. Sometimes, as sleepers, they might remain hidden for long periods before being activated. These were also potential fifth columnists, poised to go into battle should war erupt between East and West. Illegals operated beneath the official radar, and therefore could not be financed in ways that might be traced or communicate through secure diplomatic channels. But unlike spies accredited to an embassy, they left few traces for counterintelligence investigators to follow. Every Soviet embassy contained a permanent KGB station, or residentura, with a number of KGB officers in various official guises, all under the command of a resident, head of station in MI6 parlance, or station chief to the CIA. One task facing Western counterintelligence was working out which Soviet officials were genuine diplomats and which were really spies. Tracking down the illegals was far harder. The first chief directorate, FCD, was the KGB department responsible for foreign intelligence. Within this, Directorate S, standing for Special, trained, deployed, and managed the illegals. Vasily Gordievsky was formally recruited into Directorate S in 1960. The KGB maintained an office inside the Institute of International Relations, staffed by two officers on the lookout for potential recruits. Vasily mentioned to his bosses in Directorate S that his younger brother, proficient in languages, might be interested in the same line of work. Early in 1961, Oleg Gordievsky was invited in for a chat, and then told to go to a building near the KGB headquarters in Dzerzhinsky Square, where he was politely interviewed, in German, by a middle-aged woman, who complimented him on his grasp of the language. From that instant, he was part of the system. Gordievsky did not seek to join the KGB. This was not a club you applied to. It chose you. Gordievsky's time at the university was nearing an end when he was sent to East Berlin for a 6-month work experience posting as a translator in the Russian embassy. Thrilled at the prospect of his first trip abroad, Gordievsky's excitement spiked when he was called into Directorate S for a briefing on East Germany. The communist-ruled German Democratic Republic was a Soviet satellite, but that did not make it immune from the attentions of the KGB. Vasily was already living there as an illegal. Oleg readily agreed to make contact with his brother and carry out a few small tasks for his new unofficial employer. Gordievsky arrived in East Berlin on August 12, 1961, and traveled to a student hostel inside the KGB enclave in the suburb of Karlshorst. Over the previous months, the stream of East Germans fleeing to the west through West Berlin had reached a torrent. By 1961, some 3.5 million East Germans, roughly 20% of the entire population, had joined the mass exodus from communist rule. Gordievsky awoke the next morning to find that East Berlin had been invaded by bulldozers. The East German government, prompted by Moscow, was taking radical steps to staunch the flow. The construction of the Berlin Wall was underway, a physical barrier to cut off west from East Berlin and the rest of East Germany. The anti-fascist protection wall was, in reality, a prison perimeter, erected by East Germany to keep its own citizens penned in. More than 150 miles of concrete and wire, with bunkers, anti-vehicle trenches, and chain fencing, the Berlin Wall was the physical manifestation of the Iron Curtain, and one of the nastiest structures man has ever built. Gordievsky watched in horrified awe as East German workers tore up the streets alongside the border to make them impassable to vehicles, and troops unrolled miles of barbed wire. Some East Germans, realizing that their escape route was closing fast, made desperate bids for freedom by clambering over the barricades or attempting to swim the canals that formed part of the border. Guards lined up along the frontier with orders to shoot anyone attempting to cross from east to west. The new wall made a powerful impression on the 22-year-old Gordievsky. Only a physical barrier, reinforced by armed guards in their watchtowers, could keep the East Germans in their socialist paradise and stop them fleeing to the west. But Gordievsky's shock at the overnight construction of the Berlin Wall did not prevent him from faithfully carrying out the orders of the KGB. Fear of authority was instinctive, the habit of obedience ingrained. Directorate S had provided the name of a German woman, a former KGB informant. Gordievsky's instructions were to sound her out and establish if she was prepared to continue providing information. He found her address through a local police station. The middle-aged woman who answered the door seemed unfazed by the sudden arrival of a young man holding a bunch of flowers. Over a cup of tea, she made it clear that she was prepared to continue cooperating with the KGB. Gordievsky eagerly wrote up his first KGB report. Only months later did he realize what had really happened. It was I, rather than she, who was being tested. That Christmas he linked up with Vasily, who was living under a false identity in Leipzig. Oleg did not reveal to Vasily his horror at the construction of the Berlin Wall. His older brother was already a professional KGB officer, who would not have approved of such ideological wavering. Just as their mother had concealed her true feelings from her husband, so the brothers kept their secrets from each other. Oleg had no idea what Vasily was really doing in East Germany, and Vasily had no clue what Oleg was really feeling. The brothers attended a performance of The Christmas Oratorio, which left Oleg intensely moved. Russia seemed a spiritual desert, by comparison, where only approved composers could be heard, and class-hostile church music, such as Bach's, was deemed decadent and bourgeois and banned. Gordievsky was profoundly affected by the few months he spent in East Germany. He had witnessed the great physical and symbolic division of Europe into rival ideologies. He had tasted cultural fruits denied to him in Moscow, and he had started spying. It was exciting to have an early taste of what I might do if I joined the KGB. In reality, he already had. Back in Moscow, Gordievsky was told to report for duty at the KGB on July 31st, 1962. Why did he join an organization enforcing an ideology he had already started to question? KGB work was glamorous, offering the promise of foreign travel. Secrecy is seductive. He was also ambitious. The KGB might change. He might change. Russia might change. And the pay and privileges were good. Olga Gordievsky was dismayed to learn that her younger son would be following his father and brother into the intelligence service. For once, she openly voiced her anger at the regime and the apparatus of oppression that sustained it. Oleg pointed out that he would not be working for the internal KGB, but in the foreign section, the first chief directorate, an elite organization staffed by intellectuals speaking foreign languages, doing sophisticated work that required skill and education. "It's not really like the KGB," he told her. "It's really intelligence and diplomatic work." Olga turned away and left the room. Anton Gordievsky said nothing. Oleg detected no pride in his father's demeanor. Years later, when he came to understand the full scale of Stalinist repression, Gordievsky wondered whether his father, now approaching retirement, had been ashamed of all those crimes and atrocities committed by the KGB, and simply afraid to discuss the work of the KGB with his own son. Or perhaps Anton Gordievsky was struggling to maintain his double life, a pillar of the KGB, too terrified to warn his son against what he was getting into. In his last summer as a civilian, Gordievsky joined Stander Kaplan at the Institute's holiday camp on the Black Sea coast. Kaplan had decided to stay on for an additional month before returning to join the STB, Czechoslovakia's formidable intelligence service. The two friends would soon be colleagues, allies in espionage on behalf of the Soviet bloc. For a month, they camped under the pines, ran every day, swam, sunbathed, and discussed women, music, and politics. Kaplan was increasingly critical of the communist system. Gordievsky was flattered to be the recipient of such dangerous confidences. There was an understanding between us, a trust. Soon after his return to Czechoslovakia, Kaplan wrote a letter to Gordievsky. In among the gossip about the girls he had met, and the fine time they would have together if his friend came to visit, "We'll empty all the pubs and wine cellars in Prague," Kaplan made a highly significant request. "Oleg, might you have a copy of Pravda with Yevtushenko's poem about Stalin?" The poem in question was Heirs of Stalin by Yevgeny Yevtushenko, a direct attack on Stalinism by one of Russia's most outspoken and influential poets. The poem was a demand that the Soviet government ensure that Stalin would never rise again, and a warning that some in the leadership still hankered for the brutal Stalinist past. By the past, I mean the neglect of the people's welfare, false charges, the jailing of the innocent. "Why care?" some say, but I can't remain inactive while Stalin's heirs walk this earth. The poem had caused a sensation when it was published in the official newspaper of the Communist Party and had also been reprinted in Czechoslovakia. It had a powerful effect on some of our people, with a certain tinge of discontent. Kaplan wrote to Gordievsky. He said he wanted to compare the Czech translation to the original Russian. But in reality, Kaplan was sending a coded message of complicity to his friend, an acknowledgement that they shared the sentiments expressed by Yevtushenko, and, like the poet, would not remain inactive in the face of Stalin's legacy. The KGB's Red Banner Elite Training Academy, deep in the woods, 50 miles north of Moscow, was codenamed School 101, an ironic and entirely unconscious echo of George Orwell's Room 101 in 1984, the basement torture chamber, where the party breaks a prisoner's resistance by subjecting him to his worst nightmare. Here, Gordievsky and 120 other trainee KGB officers would be inducted into the deepest secrets of Soviet spycraft, intelligence and counterintelligence, recruiting and running spies, legals and illegals, agents and double agents, weapons, unarmed combat and surveillance, the arcane arts and language of this strange trade. Some of the most important instruction was in surveillance detection and evasion, known as dry cleaning, or proverka in KGB jargon. How to spot when you were being followed and dodge surveillance in a way that would appear accidental rather than intentional, since a target that is obviously surveillance-aware is likely to be a trained intelligence operative. "The intelligence officer's behavior should not cause suspicion," the KGB instructors declared. "If a surveillance service notices that a foreigner is blatantly checking for a tail, it will be stimulated to work more secretly, more tenaciously, and with more ingenuity." Being able to make contact with an agent without being watched, or even while under surveillance, is central to every clandestine operation. In Western spy parlance, an officer or agent operating undetected is said to have gone black. In test after test, the KGB students would be sent off to link up with a specific person at a precise location, drop off or pick up information, try to identify whether and how they were being followed, throw off the tail without appearing to do so, and arrive at the designated place spotlessly dry cleaned. Surveillance was the responsibility of the KGB's 7th Directorate. Professional watchers, highly trained in the art of tailing a suspect, would take part in the exercises, and at the end of each day the student trainee and the surveillance team compared notes. Proverka was exhausting, competitive, time-consuming, and nerve-shredding. Gordievsky found he was very good at it. Oleg learned how to set up a signal sight, a secret sign left in a public place, a chalk mark on a lamppost, for example, that meant nothing to a casual observer, but would tell a spy to meet at a certain place and time. How to make a brush contact, physically passing a message or item to another person without being spotted. How to make a dead letter drop, leaving a message or cash at a particular spot to be picked up by another without making direct contact. He was taught codes and ciphers, recognition signals, secret writing, preparation of microdots, photography and disguise. There were classes on economics and politics, as well as ideological tuition to reinforce the young spy's commitment to Marxism-Leninism. As one of Oleg's fellow students observed, these cliched formulas and concepts had the character of ritual incantations, something akin to daily and hourly affirmations of loyalty. Veteran officers, who had already served abroad, gave lectures on Western culture and etiquette to prepare recruits for understanding and combating bourgeois capitalism. Gordievsky adopted his first spy name. Soviet and Western intelligence services used the same method for choosing a pseudonym. It should be close to the real name, with the same initial letter, because that way, if a person addressed you by your real name, someone who only knew you by your spy name might well assume he or she had misheard. Gordievsky chose the name Gordievsev. Like every other student, he swore eternal loyalty to the KGB. I commit myself to defend my country to the last drop of blood and to keep state secrets. He did this without qualms. He also joined the Communist Party, another requirement of admission. He might have his doubts. Many did. But that did not preclude him from joining the KGB and the party with wholehearted commitment and sincerity. And besides, the KGB was thrilling. So, far from being an Orwellian nightmare, the year-long training course at School 101 was the most enjoyable period of his young life, a time of excitement and anticipation. His fellow recruits were selected for their intelligence and ideological conformity, but also for the spirit of adventure common to all intelligence services. We had chosen careers in the KGB because they held out the prospect of action. Secrecy forges intense bonds. Even his parents had little idea where Oleg was or what he was doing. To make it into service in the FCD was the concealed and open dream of the majority of young officers of state security. But only a few were made worthy of this honor, wrote Leonid Shebashin, who attended School 101 at around the same time as Oleg and would end up a KGB general. The work united intelligence officers in a unique camaraderie with its own traditions, discipline, conventions, and special professional language. By the summer of 1963, Gordievsky had been fully adopted into the KGB Brotherhood. When he swore to defend the motherland to his last breath and his last secret, he meant it. Vasily Gordievsky was working hard for Directorate S, the illegal section of the FCD. He had also started to drink heavily, not necessarily a drawback in a service that prized the ability to consume vast amounts of vodka after work without falling over. An illegal specialist, he moved from place to place under different aliases, servicing the undercover network, passing on messages and money to other hidden agents. Vasily never told his younger brother what he was doing, but he hinted at exotic locations, including Mozambique, Vietnam, Sweden, and South Africa. Oleg hoped to follow his brother into this exhilarating undercover world overseas. Instead, he was told to report to Directorate S in Moscow, where he would be preparing documentation for other illegals. Trying to mask his disappointment, on August 20, 1963, Gordievsky climbed into his best suit and reported for work at KGB headquarters, the complex of buildings that stands near the Kremlin, part prison, part archive, the bustling nerve center of Soviet intelligence. At its heart stood the sinister Lubyanka, a neo-Baroque palace originally built for the All Russia Insurance Company, whose basement housed the KGB torture cells. Among KGB officers, the KGB control center was known as the Monastery, or, more simply, the Center. Instead of going undercover in some glamorous foreign location, Gordievsky found himself shuffling paper, a galley slave, filling out forms. Each illegal required a fake persona, with a convincing backstory, a new identity with complete biography and forged paperwork. Each illegal had to be sustained, instructed, and financed, requiring a complex arrangement of signal sites, dead drops, and brush contacts. Britain was seen as particularly fertile ground for planting illegals, since there was no system of identity cards in the country and no central registration bureau. West Germany, America, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand were all prime targets. Placed in the German section, Oleg spent his days creating people who did not exist. For 2 years, he lived in a world of double lives, sending counterfeit spies into the outer world and meeting those who had returned. The center was stalked by living ghosts, heroes of Soviet espionage in their dotage. In the corridors of Directorate S, Gordievsky was introduced to Konon Trofimovich Molody, alias Gordon Lonsdale, one of the most successful illegals in history. In 1943, the KGB had appropriated the identity of a dead Canadian child named Gordon Arnold Lonsdale and given it to Molody, who had been raised in North America and spoke faultless English. Molody / Lonsdale settled in London in 1954 and, posing as a jovial salesman of jukeboxes and bubblegum machines, recruited the so-called Portland Spy Ring, a network of informants gathering naval secrets. A KGB dentist had drilled several unnecessary holes in his teeth before he left Moscow, which meant Molody could simply open his mouth and point out the KGB-made cavities to confirm his identity to other Soviet spies. A tip-off from a CIA mole had led to Molody's arrest and conviction for espionage, although even at his trial, the British court was uncertain of his real name. When Gordievsky met him, Molody had just returned to Moscow after being swapped for a British businessman arrested on spying charges in Moscow. A similarly fabled figure was William Genrichovich Fischer, alias Rudolf Abel, the illegal whose spying in the US had earned him a 30-year sentence before he was exchanged for the downed U-2 pilot, Gary Powers, in 1962. But the most famous Soviet spy in semi-retirement was British. Kim Philby had been recruited by the NKVD in 1933, rose up the ranks of MI6 while feeding vast reams of intelligence to the KGB, and finally defected to the Soviet Union in January 1963, to the deep and abiding embarrassment of the British government. He now lived in a comfortable flat in Moscow, attended by minders, an Englishman to his fingertips, as one KGB officer put it, reading the cricket scores in old copies of The Times, eating Oxford marmalade, and frequently drinking himself into a stupor. Philby was revered as a legend within the KGB, and he continued to do odd jobs for Soviet intelligence, including running a training course for English-speaking officers, analyzing occasional cases, and even helping to motivate the Soviet ice hockey team. Like Molody and Fischer, Philby gave lectures to star-struck young spies. But the reality of life after KGB espionage was anything but happy. Molody took to drink and died in mysterious circumstances on a mushroom-picking expedition. Fischer became deeply disillusioned. Philby attempted to kill himself. All three would end up celebrated on Soviet postage stamps. To anyone who cared to look closely, and few Russians did, the contrast between the myth and reality of the KGB was self-evident. The center was a spotlessly clean, brightly lit, amoral bureaucracy, a place at once ruthless, prissy, and puritanical, where international crimes were conceived with punctilious attention to detail. From its earliest days, Soviet intelligence operated without ethical restraint. In addition to collecting and analyzing intelligence, the KGB organized political warfare, media manipulation, disinformation, forgery, intimidation, kidnapping, and murder. The 13th Department, or the Directorate for Special Tasks, specialized in sabotage and assassination. Homosexuality was illegal in the USSR, but homosexuals were recruited to entrap gay foreigners, who could then be blackmailed. The KGB was unapologetically unprincipled. Yet it was a prudish, hypocritical, and moralistic place. Officers were forbidden to drink during working hours, though many drank prodigiously at all other times. Gossip about the private lives of colleagues swirled around the KGB, as in most offices, with the difference that, in the center, scandal and tittle-tattle could destroy careers and end lives. The KGB took an intrusive interest in the domestic arrangements of its employees, for no life was private in the Soviet Union. Officers were expected to get married, have children, and stay married. There was calculation as well as control in this. A married KGB officer was considered less likely to defect while abroad, since his wife and family could be held as hostages. 2 years after joining Directorate S, Gordievsky concluded that he was not going to follow in his brother's footsteps as a deep cover spy posted abroad. But Vasily himself may have been the main reason Oleg was rejected for illegals work. According to KGB logic, having more than one family member abroad, and particularly having two in the same country, might be an inducement to defect. Gordievsky was bored and frustrated. A job that had seemed to promise adventure and excitement had turned out to be humdrum in the extreme. The world beyond the Iron Curtain, he had read about in Western newspapers, seemed tantalizingly out of reach. So he decided to get married. I wanted to go abroad as soon as possible, and the KGB never sent unmarried men abroad. I was in a hurry to find a wife. A woman with German language skills would be ideal, since they might then be posted to Germany together. Yelena Akopian was training to be a German teacher. She was 21, half Armenian, intelligent, dark-eyed, and sharply witty. She was a master of the one-line put-down, which he found attractive and alluring, for a time. They met at the home of a mutual friend. What sparked between them had less to do with passion than a shared ambition. Like Oleg, Yelena longed to travel abroad, and imagined a life far beyond the confines of the cramped flat where she lived with her parents and five siblings. Gordievsky's few previous relationships had been brief and unsatisfying. Yelena seemed to offer a glimpse of what a modern Soviet woman might be, less conventional than the female students he had met before, with an unpredictable sense of humor. She pronounced herself a feminist, although in 1960s Russia the term was strictly limited. He told himself that he loved her. They got engaged, Gordievsky later reflected, without much real thought or self-examination on either side, and then married without fanfare a few months later, for reasons that were less than romantic. She would improve his chances of promotion, and he was her passport out of Moscow. This was a KGB marriage of convenience, though neither admitted it to the other. Late in 1965 came the break Gordievsky had been waiting for. A slot opened up for a post running illegals in Denmark. His cover job would be that of a consular official dealing with visas and inheritances. In reality, he would be working for Line N, standing for Nelegalni, or illegals, responsible for the operational fieldwork of Directorate S. Gordievsky was offered the job, managing a network of undercover spies in Denmark. He accepted with alacrity and delight. As Kim Philby observed after he was recruited into the KGB in 1933, "I did not hesitate. One does not look twice at an offer of enrollment in an elite force." Chapter 2. Uncle Gormson. Oleg and Yelena Gordievsky landed in Copenhagen on a glittering frosty day in January 1966 and entered a fairy tale. As one MI6 officer later remarked, "If you had to choose a city to demonstrate the advantages of Western democracy over Russian communism, you could hardly do better than Copenhagen." The capital of Denmark was beautiful, clean, modern, rich, and to the eyes of a couple newly emerged from the drab oppression of Soviet life, almost impossibly alluring. Here were sleek cars, shiny office buildings, smart designer furniture, and smiling Nordic people with magnificent dentistry. There were teeming cafes, bright restaurants serving exotic food, shops selling a bewildering array of goods. To Gordievsky's famished eyes, the Danes seemed not just brighter and more alive, but culturally nourished. He was astounded by the range of books available in the first library he entered, but even more surprised to be allowed to borrow as many as he wanted, and to keep the plastic bag he took them away in. There seemed to be very few policemen. The Soviet embassy consisted of three stucco villas on Kristianiagade, in the northern part of the city, more like a grand gated hotel than a Soviet enclave, with immaculate sweeping gardens, a sports center, and a social club. The Gordievskys moved into a newly built apartment, with high ceilings, wooden floors, and a fitted kitchen. He was allocated a Volkswagen Beetle and a cash advance of $700 every month for entertaining contacts. Copenhagen seemed to be alive with music. Bach, Handel, Haydn, Telemann, composers he had never been allowed to hear in Soviet Russia. There was a very good reason, he reflected, why ordinary Soviet citizens were not permitted to travel abroad. Who but a fully indoctrinated KGB officer would be able to taste such freedoms and resist the urge to stay? Of the 20 officials in the Soviet embassy, just 6 were genuine diplomats, while the rest worked for the KGB or the GRU, Soviet military intelligence. The resident, Leonid Zaitsev, a charming and conscientious officer, seemed oblivious to the fact that most of his underlings were incompetent, lazy, or crooked, and usually all 3. They expended far more energy on fiddling their expenses than actually spying. The broad remit of the KGB was to cultivate Danish contacts, recruit informants, and target possible agents. This, Gordievsky swiftly realized, was an invitation to corruption, since most officers simply invented their interactions with Danes, falsified bills, made up their reports, and pocketed their allowances. The center does not appear to have noticed the anomaly that few of its personnel in Copenhagen spoke good Danish, and some spoke none at all. Gordievsky was determined to show that he was not like the rest. Already proficient in Swedish, he set about learning Danish. His mornings were spent processing visa applications, in obedience to his cover job in the consulate. The spying began at lunchtime. The KGB illegals network in Scandinavia was patchy. Much of Gordievsky's work was administrative, leaving money or messages at dead drops, monitoring signal sites, and maintaining clandestine contact with the undercover spies, most of whom he never met face-to-face or knew by name. If an illegal left an orange peel under a specific park bench, this meant, I am in danger, whereas an apple core indicated, I am leaving the country tomorrow. These complex arrangements sometimes descended into farce. At one signal site, Oleg left a bent nail on a windowsill in a public toilet to indicate to an illegal that he should pick up cash at a predetermined dead drop site. The answering signal from the undercover agent, acknowledging that the message had been received, was a beer bottle cap left in the same place. On returning to the spot, Oleg found the cap from a bottle of ginger beer. Was ginger beer, in spy signaling, the same as ordinary beer, or did this have another meaning? After an intense all-night discussion with colleagues back at the Residentura, he reached a conclusion that the spy did not see any difference between one bottle cap and another. In Denmark, births and deaths were registered by the Protestant Church and recorded by hand in large ledgers. With the help of a skilled forger from Moscow, any number of new identities could be fabricated from scratch by altering church records. He began cultivating clerics to gain access to the registers and organizing burglaries at various churches. I was breaking new ground, he said later. The church registers of Denmark contain a number of Danes entirely invented by Oleg Gordievsky. In the meantime, he set about recruiting informants, agents, and clandestine couriers. That's the main purpose of our life here, Zaitsev told him. After months of cultivation, working under the alias Gordonov, his mother's maiden name, he persuaded a schoolteacher and his wife to act as a live letterbox, passing messages to and from illegals. He befriended a Danish policeman, but after a few meetings began to wonder whether he was recruiting the man or if it was the other way around. Less than a year after his arrival in Copenhagen, Gordievsky was joined by a KGB officer of a very different stamp from the others. Mikhail Petrovich Lyubimov was a booming, cheerful, highly intelligent Ukrainian whose father had served in the Cheka, the Bolshevik secret police. Lyubimov had graduated from the Moscow State Institute of International Relations 4 years ahead of Gordievsky, and then wrote a thesis for the KGB entitled English National Character and Its Use in Operational Work. In 1957, on KGB orders, he seduced an American girl at the World Youth Festival in Moscow. 4 years later, he was deployed to Britain as a Soviet press attaché, while recruiting informants within trade unions, student groups, and the British establishment. He spoke English with a fruity, upper-class accent, larded with old-fashioned Britishisms. What ho!